Hey there. If you enjoy Latino USA, you'll love NPR's Planet Money. It's full of insightful, funny stories about how the world works. Things like how gyms trick us into never showing up and why there are so few women programmers. Plus, useful stuff like how to steal a million barrels of oil. Find Planet Money now at itunes.com/NPR. From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
The idea that the press represents individual people, that it's a tool of democracy, I think that is weaker now than it ever has been.
Today, censorship in the Americas. We talk with journalists and artists fighting for their right to express and share, including a Pittsburgh nonprofit that's giving a new home to persecuted writers.
It wasn't just to survive. It wasn't just to avoid getting killed. It wasn't just avoiding something bad happening to me. It was to keep writing.
Plus, we ask, who gets the word out when Latinos have no one to speak for them? All this and more coming up on Latino USA as we talk about being censored. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No se vayan. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. I decided to become a journalist many years ago because of a generation of brave Mexican women who were reporters, like Elena Poniatowska and Blanche Petrich, who inspired me to tell truth to power. But today, Mexican journalists are dying, sometimes very gruesome deaths, for refusing to stay silent. More journalists have been killed for reporting on the Mexican drug war than have been killed while reporting on the war in Afghanistan. And if you count the number of Mexican journalists whose killing has not been categorized as an official murder of a journalist, that number is almost as high as those killed in Syria. But direct violence isn't the only threat to journalism. Governments throughout the Americas are passing laws and measures restricting freedom of speech. Now, as Americans, we might feel that the First Amendment protects us as journalists, but even here in the United States, our freedom has its limits.
I mean, I've been stopped at the border since 2006, since I started working on this series of films looking at U.S. post-9/11.
That's Academy Award-winning filmmaker and journalist Laura Poitras speaking on the show Democracy Now! And today, we're going to start our show looking at the many ways censorship is happening throughout our hemisphere. I'm joined in the studio by Carlos Lauria. He's the senior coordinator of the Americas program at the Committee to Protect Journalists, or CPJ. Carlos, it's good to see you on Latino USA.
Great to see you. Thank you for having me, Maria.
And joining us from Washington, D.C. is John Dingus. He's professor of journalism at Columbia University School of Journalism. He's a specialist in Latin America and a former colleague of mine at NPR. Hey, John.
Well, good to be here.
Let's go actually to the place where I was born, Mexico. What is the status of journalists in Mexico?
More than 70,000 people have been killed in Mexico in drug-related crimes. So there's a wave of unprecedented violence. What is very serious in the case of journalists is that many of these reporters who have been killed have been digging into issues that are affecting the daily lives of citizens in Mexico. Crime, the wave of violence, the collusion between crime and authorities, human rights abuses. The wave of violence is creating a climate of terror and intimidation. Let me give you a recent example. In the border city of Matamoros in the state of Tamaulipas, the paper, the main paper there, the main daily, El Mañana, is forbidden, you know, to publish any stories related to crime. The Gulf Cartel dominates all sectors of society and tell journalists what to publish and what not to publish. But the wave of violence was so intense that the Daily El Mañana published a story on crime because there were dozens of people being killed in broad daylight. Next day, armed men stormed the newsroom and abducted the editor. They beat him up and they tell him, next time you're going to be killed.
Oh my God, this is horrible. So the statistic that Mexico is one of the most dangerous places in the world to be a reporter, in fact, stands true.
No question about it. 50 journalists killed or disappeared only in the last 7 years. You have all these regions where there's an information vacuum. Social media has started to fill that vacuum. Now, Mexicans, including journalists, are starting to increasingly use Twitter, Facebook, and social media networks to get information and to be informed of what's going on in their communities.
So, John, when you hear about this, you spend a lot of the early parts of your career covering the wars in Central America. How do you compare what you're seeing now in terms of press freedom in Latin America with that time of the wars in Central America?
There's serious violence against journalists in places like Honduras, Guatemala to a certain extent. Governments are to be held responsible for not giving adequate protection, perhaps, for journalists. But the idea that journalists would be targeted by governments, I don't believe, Carlos perhaps can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't know of any cases of that.
We put out a report because there's been a rush of killings since the 2009 coup against former President Manuel Zelaya. The presence of the Mexican drug cartels, particularly in the Atlantic coast in Honduras, is a factor. The violence of criminals is rampant. The criminal justice system is completely dysfunctional. Impunity is a norm. None of these cases are solved. And this obviously perpetuates a climate of impunity where journalists and human rights activists are wide open to attacks.
All right, so let's move into South America, where you have a different kind of a threat to press freedom. Really, some say coming directly from the government. And I want to play a clip from a comedian John Oliver's show last week tonight. This is a clip where he blasts Ecuadorian President Rafael Correa for calling out his Twitter trolls during his weekly show.
I would stop making fun of Correa's oversensitivity were it not for the fact he has a history of stifling dissent in Ecuador. He's clamped down on journalists in both ways, large and small, from suing a newspaper that said he was acting like a dictator to humiliating a young female reporter who asked him a tough question, calling her a horrible fatty.
All right, so John Dinges, is John Oliver raising a point here that a different kind of government repression exists now in South America?
Correa has at least 60%, probably higher, approval ratings. The John Oliver clip is hilarious because Correa sees himself as somebody who can make jokes on his speeches, but he actually has cracked down on cartoons. So when people make jokes and the jokes are at the government's expense, there's a law called the Organic Communications Law that was passed in 2013, which provides a tribunal. And they have to defend themselves for things like making a joke about the government or, of course, also making a joke about somebody's ethnicity or calling somebody fatty, gordita, I'm sure is the word that he was using in Spanish.
On paper, for example, the Ecuadorian law seems to be saying Ecuador wants to recognize it in the past, in our country. The media has been run by a wealthy elite that is not racially diverse, not diverse in terms of its class representation. But Carlos, in fact, the Committee to Protect Journalists is very concerned about what's going on in Ecuador right now.
It doesn't sound that good in paper. In fact, we had serious concerns when the law was drafted that there's been dozens of media outlets and journalists sanctioned for this media law that introduces concepts like media lynching. So if a public official criticizes in more than one media outlet, he can sue those media for this concept of media lynching. This is one of the many, many prohibitions that are vague and that, you know, have really caused clearly a chilling effect.
So John Dinges, put this in context in terms of where Venezuela comes down.
Venezuela kind of invented this. What Chavez did back in the early 2000s was he passed some laws which, as you noted before, some of these laws are easily portrayed as defending the rights of people, because ordinary people see the press, in particularly in Ecuador, as coming out of a history of, you know, way in the past they supported a dictator. More recently, many of the media were owned by banks. There was a banking crisis in which many people lost their savings. The logic is that because the media have abused their power, they have been used to defend certain economic interests against the interests of the people. They must be monitored. They must be controlled by the government.
I can completely see, Dinges, where there's like, you know, this rebellion against los medios de comunicación, which is now really represent us. But it's like, do you really want the government to be the one deciding that? Now, you know, in the United States, we believe, right, we hold so proudly onto this notion of our free press. So is it wrong for us to be looking at Latin American journalism through a very kind of American Western perspective? Are we wrong?
You know, what many of these governments say is that press freedom conditions in the U.S. have seriously deteriorated, and we don't apply a double standard, and we have done an exhaustive investigation into U.S. practices and found that the aggressive prosecution of leakers, threats through the Espionage Act, the lack of access to information, and especially leaks and the Snowden revelations of massive surveillance of communications have led to, you know, a climate here also that is no longer a model for the rest of the world, and there's a legitimate criticism.
John Dinges, final words. Are you more concerned about where things are going?
I think we're in for a difficult period. On balance, you have, aside from the problem of violence that we started out talking about, which I think can get better over time, but the idea of a kind of institutional control over the media is increasing in force. And the idea that the press represents individual people, that it's a tool of democracy, I think that is weaker now than it ever has been.
John Dinges, Carlos Lauria, thank you for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
That was John Dinges, professor of journalism at Columbia University, and Carlos Lauria, America's coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists. For an extended version of our conversation, check out our website, latinousa.org. Coming up on Latino USA, a controversial media law in Ecuador.
Really, do we think the media has no limits, that you can and should publish just anything? I think our boundaries ought to be rooted in our modern definition of human rights.
Stay with us. No se vayan.
Acércate, entra por ahí. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Inada, maker of the DreamWave massage chair, Japanese crafted with shiatsu point detection and 16 pre-programmed massages, including morning, night, and full body sessions. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. And the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems, at pewtrusts.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. A year and a half ago, the government of Ecuador passed a media law they said was aimed at reducing sexist and racist content and aimed at breaking up the country's entrenched media monopolies. But most journalists in Ecuador say the law has become a tool for censorship that has allowed President Rafael Correa to go after his critics. Here's reporter Ruxandra Guidi with our story.
It's 9 a.m. The sky is gray and drizzly in typically sunny Quito, but still there's a growing crowd of protesters here. They've come to lend support to Javier Bonilla, a political cartoonist nicknamed Bonil.
I think he's among the few left who can still express himself freely in the country.
Mildon Castillo Maldonado is a lawyer and a friend of Bonil's. The cartoonist has made fun of every Ecuadorian president during his 30-year career. But now he's in trouble for it.
Verdaderamente no existe libertad de expresión en el país.
We really don't have freedom of speech here because whoever bothers our president is persecuted. Our president doesn't like the truth, and Bonil has always given him the truth, with a dose of humor.
Y Bonil ha dicho la verdad con humor siempre.
Since Ecuador's media law has been in effect, Bonil and his paper, El Universo, have been hit with fines, lawsuits, and defamation charges by the government. Today, he's accused of publishing racist and classist content. A cartoon mocking an assemblyman is incompetent and corrupt. The assemblyman happens to be black.
Los derechos de las personas solamente pueden garantizarse a través de un debido proceso.
Bonil's hearing is being held at Supercom, the government agency in charge of enforcing the media law. His lawyer, Ramiro Garcia, calls this a sham trial. He says Supercom hasn't presented any concrete evidence against his client.
It turns out that the report that we have, the basis of these accusations and this trial, haven't been made public. In other words, we have no idea what we are dealing with.
Bonil isn't the first member of the Ecuadorian media to face retribution from the government for publishing content that it deems offensive. According to Supercom, there have been at least 200 fines and lawsuits carried out against media organizations and journalists. For 32 years, Diario Hoy was one of Ecuador's most respected dailies. But about 6 months ago, it stopped publishing due to pressure from the media law. That's what its director, Jaime Mantilla, says.
The communications law is terribly restrictive, not just to journalists, but also to the rights of their audience.
Mantilla says the government fined his newspaper for critical editorials and cartoons. And what's more, it stopped advertising with the paper. That turned out to be a kiss of death because the state is the country's main buyer of ads.
La ley de comunicación.
The law basically does away with freedom of the press in Ecuador.
But the head of Supercom, Carlos Ochoa Hernandez, doesn't buy that argument. Speaking at a press conference, he says the problems at Diario Hoy are not due to the law, but to poor management.
It's a bold statement, to say the least, that Diario Hoy pretends to blame the law for the failed administration of the paper. That's what led to its end.
A la suspensión de su edición impresa.
One of the law's biggest champions is Romel Jurado. He holds a copy of the media law booklet in his hands with obvious pride.
Bueno, esto ya es.
You think this law was the worst insult the government could have made towards Ecuadorian traditional media?
Jurado is one of the architects of the law and also a consultant with Supercom. He says the media in Ecuador would often publish offensive and inaccurate content, so the law was designed to keep outlets in check.
They weren't used to any kinds of control. They were omnipotent.
Jurado cites the case of a daily newspaper that got fined for publishing photos of half-naked women and sex-tinged headlines, or TV news coverage that failed to reflect Ecuador's ethnic diversity.
Really, do we think the media has no limits, that you can and should publish just anything? I think our boundaries ought to be rooted in our modern definition of human rights.
One thing the law has changed is radio. Before, 90% of radio frequencies in Ecuador were in private hands. Now a third of all frequencies are public, serving rural and indigenous communities. Some would say they're also serving Ecuador's president, Rafael Correa. He takes to the airwaves regularly to lambast his critics in both traditional and social media. Here he is going after an anonymous Twitter account that regularly mocks him. He's shooting back with his own sarcasm.
So should we go after the media anonymously and insult them? Isn't that what the free flow of information is all about? That's ridiculous. We need to take offense to this, and let's respond on social media.
And respond people did. Soon after Correa's comments, that anonymous Twitter account started receiving death threats and shut down. Meanwhile, the political cartoonist Bonil has escaped having to pay a fine. Instead, Supercom asked him and his paper to publish an apology, and they warned Bonil against more offensive cartoons. The next day, the newspaper put out a tiny notice on its webpage. "We're sorry if Bonil's cartoon offended you," it read. "But this doesn't mean we'll stop fighting the media law to the degree that we can." For Latino USA, I'm Ruxandra Guidi in Quito.
And we had some questions about how our reporter, Ruxandra Guidi, has dealt with this new communication law herself in Ecuador. To get her take on the situation, Ruxandra now joins us from Quito. Welcome to Latino USA, Ruxandra.
Thanks, Maria.
So the law seems quite confusing in a lot of ways and very slippery, but give us a sense of how you, as a journalist who was trained in the United States and is now working in Latin America, has it affected you at all in the work that you've been doing?
You know, I haven't felt any censorship in my own work in the sense of me being fined or being criticized by the president during his state broadcast show, where he often does criticize journalists. But I have noticed some self-censorship, which is actually pretty scary. You know, I got here and I was asked, one of the first stories I was asked to do was about the communications law. It'd been maybe 3 weeks since I got here, and I was on a tourist visa and had applied for my journalist visa. And I have to tell you, I was pretty terrified. I thought, what if I do this story that is taking a look, a deeper look at the media law, and then I won't get my visa? So I found myself really questioning my work and who I should talk to, whether I should like tell people that I plan on staying here. And I think that happens a lot, at least with international journalists. But in the case of Ecuadorian journalists, I think they have a lot more to fear from this law.
Supercom feels a little bit like, you know, Big Brother and the Matrix. So in the end, were you to be called in and questioned for any of your reporting, who decides exactly whether or not something has crossed the line? And is that line very clear for you as a working journalist down there?
It's not very clear. I mean, the law was created about a year and a half ago with the idea of reforming the quality of media, which sounds like a lofty goal, really. There was an argument that there is a lot of sexist, racist, classist, and sensitive content in Ecuadorian media, and that this law would basically democratize media and make media companies accountable for the content they put out. But the truth is that a lot of journalists, the minute they cross the line in the sense of criticizing the government, affecting the public image of the government, or criticizing President Rafael Correa, that's where usually Supercom goes after you. About 2 years ago, right around the time the law was established, a journalist who was a very outspoken critic of Correa was actually pulled out of his home in the middle of the night, and he was charged with defamation. So anything could happen, really.
So you have a situation where, let's say, 50 or so government employees are deciding themselves that something is racist, sexist, classist, that it has crossed the bound. It's not like they're responding to people calling in and saying, this is offensive. They're just kind of deciding on their own?
It can go both ways. Complaints can come from citizens. That was actually the point of the Ley de Comunicación, is that it makes, at least the way it was framed, is that it makes citizens, it makes Ecuadorians accountable as media, but also it makes the public responsible. It demands the public to respond to media and to say what's right or what's not.
So, Ruxandra, do you find yourself kind of thinking like, okay, someone from Supercom is definitely going to be listening to this interview that I just did with Latino USA? Are you wondering if every little piece of work that you're doing, or are you convinced that it is being scrutinized by Supercom to see whether or not it should be censored?
You know, I do. Mostly because I know they're very active on social media. That's one place where I'm very active as a journalist. However, on the other hand, there's, you know, I've gotten together with journalist friends here, and we all agree that as far as English language content goes, the government doesn't seem to have very good tabs on, or at least not unless you're a very, you know, you're a correspondent with the AP or Bloomberg. So I don't know. It's hard to tell. I mean, I did notice to some degree a little bit of self-censorship, where I was really afraid and I was concerned what might happen, whether I might be able to get my journalist visa or not. But, you know, I try to see it in the way that I see my journalism anywhere, whether there's censorship laws or not, is if I am reporting the truth, if I am being fair and objective to the degree that I can, as in my training as a journalist, then I have nothing to worry about.
We know you only report in the truth. Thank you so much for speaking with us, Ruxandra, and stay safe.
Thanks, Maria. Great to talk to you.
As we've heard, free speech isn't a given in all countries, and it's not only in relation to journalists, it's also in relation to works of fiction. Dissident writers can be jailed, harassed, even killed. For them, the only solution might be to leave home. In Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, a nonprofit gives persecuted foreign writers a new home and a space to create. Erica Barris has our story.
For decades, Henry Reese has lived here on Sampsonia Way.
This block is 20 feet wide, roughly, and it's about 800 feet long. And there are houses only on one side, and there are garages and fences on the other side.
When Henry moved into this alley, many of the houses were blighted. He bought a few of them and fixed them up. Now the houses are safe havens for writers in exile from all over the world.
In certain countries, it can be very difficult to write, and whether it be in Iran or China or Turkey, even places we may think of as fairly free. And we've seen even now in France, there could be difficulties of a different sort.
Henry's a retired businessman and lifelong book lover. 12 years ago, he saw the famously persecuted novelist Salman Rushdie speak. It made him want to offer sanctuary to other writers with similar problems.
Literary writers, we felt it was important to protect because they don't have any institutional protection.
That's why he decided to start City of Asylum. It offers persecuted writers a new home in countries where they're free to write. There are City of Asylum programs in Europe funded by governments, and there are some in the U.S. affiliated with universities. Henry wanted his City of Asylum to be independent and in a community. The first author to come live on the street was Huang Shang, a Chinese poet who spent 12 years in prison. This is a YouTube recording of Huang reading. He was so happy to be free to write, he often performed in front of his house, drawing neighbors who didn't understand his words, but understood his exuberance. And Huang started a tradition, house poems, that is, pieces of writing actually painted on a house's exterior. Since then, City of Asylum has drawn writers from El Salvador, Burma, and India.
After all, what could be colder than a world that will not even acknowledge your presence?
Usually a writer who comes to City of Asylum gets a place to live for 2 years and help to stay in the country legally. The writer who's been on the alley the longest since 2011 is Israel Centeno. In Venezuela, Israel was a celebrated author. Then he wrote The Conspiracy. He says just the opening lines got him in trouble.
En Buenos Aires se llama bruma. En Ciudad de México le dicen neblumo.
In Buenos Aires, it's called mist. In Mexico City, they call it smog. When the wind blows from the Sahara and covers Santa Cruz de Tenerife, the islanders know it as a haze. And I was moving through smoke and ashes on the day I went out to kill the president.
El día en que salí a matar al presidente.
The conspiracy is about an assassination attempt on the country's president. It was published in 2002, just months after a failed coup against Hugo Chavez, who was then president. The government found that suspicious.
There were no charges. The police didn't grab me. Those things don't happen in Venezuela. The repression in Venezuela happens in other ways.
Israel spent years being harassed. Once a stranger hit him as he was getting out of the subway. Someone tapped his phone. He thinks it was the government. Militant leftist groups gave him death threats. For his wife, Graciela Bonet, the move to the U.S. was especially hard. When she was 17 in the 70s, her family had to leave her native Argentina because of a repressive dictatorship. In comparison, Venezuela had been a haven.
It was magnificent, and the people who lived there didn't realize all they had, because they had never suffered that kind of loss. We were coming from an extreme situation, very difficult, a disastrous government with persecutions, so it seemed amazing.
Now that's no longer the case. Israel and Graciela left Venezuela for many of the same reasons. Because of his artistic talent, the U.S. gave him a permanent green card. But starting a new life in their 50s has been difficult. Israel felt he had no choice.
It wasn't just to survive. It wasn't just to avoid getting killed. It wasn't just avoiding something bad happening to me. It was to keep writing.
To keep writing is a common drive on Sampsonia Way. A few doors down from where Israel lives is City of Asylum's latest author, Yagub Yadali, an Iranian who moved here in 2013. He doesn't speak Spanish, and Israel doesn't speak Farsi, but the two have bonded.
A country like Venezuela, which has some similarity to my country, we have many things to share with each other about our experiences, about our professional background, about our experiences in real life in our countries.
Like Israel, Yagub has slowly started making a life for himself in Pittsburgh, performing in the alley.
Salam bar Pittsburgh. Hello, Pittsburgh.
And writing frequently, which he didn't have the space to do back home. Israel, too, has been writing, still in Spanish, since coming to the U.S. His latest book begins in Venezuela and ends in Pittsburgh. For Latino USA, I'm Erica Barris in Pittsburgh.
Up on Latino USA.
It is the communities themselves that have to acknowledge that a problem exists. It's the community that has to look around and say, this is not how we want to live. What are we going to do to change this?
A conversation about the void of Latino leadership. That's coming up. No se vayan. Thanks for listening to Latino USA. So if you ever talk back to your podcast, we want you to be a part of NPR Listens. Share your opinions and your feedback on NPR's radio shows and podcasts. If you love something or if you want something to evolve, just have your say as part of NPR Listens. Learn more at nprlistens.org.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumber Liquidators, with a Floor Finder app to help find sustainably harvested flooring, including exotic and domestic hardwood, bamboo, and cork. More information is available at lumberliquidators.com or 1-800-HARDWOOD. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives, supporting efforts to improve women's economic opportunities around the world. More information is available at hewlett.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And so far today, we've talked a lot about the way speech can be muzzled. But this assumes that there's even a way for that speech to get out in the first place. And while we consistently hear from national Latino organizations about the importance of immigration reform, there's another issue simmering below the surface. Now, you may know the names Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Tamir Rice, Trayvon Martin, but you're probably way less likely to have heard about Alex Nieto, Jessica Hernandez, and Antonio Zambrano Montes. Zambrano Montes' death was captured on tape and has been garnering national attention. He had allegedly been throwing rocks at Pasco, Washington police officers before being shot to death by them.
He's an undocumented, came from Mexico, and he came here to work the apple orchards and in the Yakima Valley, in the Columbia Basin, and the Walla Walla area.
Rick Rios works with a local community group, Consejo Latino, and it's been drawing attention to Zambrano's case.
It is the communities themselves that have to acknowledge that a problem exists. It's the community that has to look around and say, this is not how we want to live. What are we going to do to change this?
But could change, like more police training or public understanding of migrant workers, be made if national Latino leadership groups like LULAC, MALTEF, and the National Council of La Raza were actually to speak up on these issues? Well, when we did a web search, none of those three national organizations even had press releases online about these deaths. When asked, in fact, LULAC, the League of United Latin American Citizens, said they had no statements available. In contrast, Presente.org, a relatively new voice, had this to say about the Pasco shooting. Quote, "We hope the DOJ's findings of extreme force and bias in Ferguson is the dawn of a new era in which local police departments are held responsible for their long history of terrorizing communities of color with excessive force and bias." So when there's a lack of unity to the national Latino message, is there any wonder that there's less national coverage when Latinos are killed? To help us answer this question and more, we're talking now with Julio Varela. He's the founder of LatinoRebels.com. And in addition, he is the digital media director here at the Futuro Media Group. Hey, Julio.
Hola, Maria. How are you?
Good. And Alida Garcia is a political strategist. She ran President Obama's Latino Vote program in 2012 and now volunteers with the New York Justice League. Alida, welcome to Latino USA.
Thank you for having me.
So, Alida, why is it that you had many Latinos going out in the protests for Michael Brown or Trayvon or Eric Garner, and yet you didn't see those kinds of protests being led by Latinos on these specific Latino killings?
This isn't an issue that's unique to Latinos. If you look at the Ferguson protests, if you look at the Eric Garner protests in New York, if you look at Dream Defenders in Florida, all of these protests and movements are happening locally. They're not dependent on a national civil rights organization pushing the narrative. But what you do see is solidarity and camaraderie between a lot of these groups across the country. And that's what's propelling this national movement. I think in the Latino case, you know, there are some national orgs. So, for example, Voto Latino, after Ferguson, teamed up with Global Grind to create a campaign called United We Win, which was focused on organizing young Black and Brown youth to turn out the vote because of their commonality in discrimination by police. Our national organizations, they've also been very busy focused on immigration reform, and we haven't been digging into the intersectionality as to how the immigration reform movement is also a criminal justice reform movement, how the mass incarceration of immigrants and immigrant detention, or how, you know, Texas state troopers gunning down a migrant in 2012 at the Texas border is a form of state violence. And we need to better explore those commonalities that, we're seeing within the African-American protest movement across the country and join in and hold our leadership accountable. But I don't think we need to sit back and wait for national organizations to do this work for us. We need to bridge ties amongst local organizations that are rising up, like you see in Pasco and you see in Denver right now.
Right. So Gregory Chris Brown, who's a professor of criminal justice at California State University of Fullerton, says that part of the problem is that because the news media often portrays Latinos as criminals, we are, quote unquote, seen as an illegal people, then the idea is kind of like, well, if a Latino got shot by the police, well, then he must have been doing something wrong, which makes me think about the way this was covered with the African-American community 30 years ago, kind of like, well, it was their fault to begin with. But when you add the element of they're an undocumented people, they're a quote-unquote an illegal people, does this add to part of the equation of why there's such a difficult time in these cases rising up, Julio?
Absolutely. Take the example of Zambrano Montes. You know, he was a Mexican national, a migrant worker. He had mental health issues. I don't think a lot of people in the United States know that Pasco, I believe, is one of the fastest growing agricultural regions in the United States. So you've seen a very strong rise in the migrant community in that area. And, you know, the changing demographics of that area lead to, I wouldn't say tension, but there has not been comfort. And I do think it lead, you know, part of that has to do with the misperceptions of what you said. If you are Latino in the United States, you must be, quote unquote, illegal, undocumented. The fact that this is still this notion of victim blaming, no one's connecting the dots, at least on a national level, that we can have all the movements we want. I don't understand why these national civil rights organizations will not say something or will not be in front of a camera. And instead, that focus on immigration, I think it's the elephant in the room. You know, we're putting so much focus on that we've kind of lost sort of the anchor in a lot of other issues in this country.
And so a difficult question, and this from an anchor who has covered this issue and cares deeply about it as an immigrant myself, but has the immigration issue essentially sucked all of the air out of the room when it comes to other problems that our community is facing?
Yes. That's the short answer. Sí, definitivamente. And it doesn't mean that we should belittle the efforts of people. But there is that sense of we've been focusing on one issue so much that we've stopped a little bit to make connections with that issue. So in the case of Antonio Zambrano Montes or in the case of Ruben Garcia, both migrant workers, you know, when you talk about violence against migrants, it's important that that issue kind of gets lost in the national immigration reform debate. We hear DHS shutdowns. We hear partisanship. We hear, you know, we got to pass this. But we haven't done that good of a job as a community to connect the dots.
All I need to say is it was the very first story that I ever reported for NPR in 1985 was about immigration reform. And here we are, and it's still unresolved. I wonder, Alida, you brought up intersectionality. Is there an element where among Latinos, we've got to deal with our own intersectionality and say, yes, there are immigrant issues, immigrant rights issues, but we've got issues around racism. We've got issues around police violence. We've got issues around poverty. Is that we as a community needs to do more intersectionality amongst ourselves? Or is this what we typically do, which is, it's my fault. I'm doing something wrong. The Latino community is doing something. We just tend to blame ourselves.
I think that there is a lot of growth, and I work on immigration reform. I've been doing it every day, 80 hours a week for the last years. And we're close. I believe we're going to pass a comprehensive immigration reform bill within the next, let's say, 3 years. But I don't want to lose sight at what this movement has done for our community. The fact that we have undocumented people who will fearlessly talk to the president of the United States about their status and their parents' status means that over the course of these years, we have begun to own our power in ways that we haven't previously. Fearlessness is going to pay it forward in every issue that we have moving forward. And I think that you see that in our young people. And now with DAPA, you're going to see that with parents because they're going to start to come out of the shadows. I just think we need to encourage proactive conversations and not get beat up in sort of how long it's taken to get immigration reform. It's only been 4 years since Democrats had control over everything and couldn't pass the DREAM Act. And we need to just better equip that power that has emerged with the tools necessary to advocate on all issues that are happening in Latino communities across the United States. On the six-month anniversary of Michael Brown's killing, I help out with digital media for Justice League, and a woman named Nanette Gutierrez commented, "Today is also the two-month anniversary of an officer killing my son, Delbert Rodriguez. May they both rest in peace." And I was touched because this mother had nowhere to turn to for people to remember that it was the anniversary of her son's killing. It was also a mother recognizing the commonality between the African-American and Latino communities. And I think that that's where we need to head. We need to work together. But I'm ready to do the work. And I think we're headed in that direction. And I'm really excited by all the young people who seem to be headed in that direction as well.
Alida Garcia is a political strategist. She joined us from WAMU in Washington, D.C. And Julio Varela is the digital media director of Futuro Media Group, which produces Latino USA. He's also the founder of LatinoRebels.com. He joined us from WGBH in Boston. Thanks again to both of you.
Thank you.
Gracias, Maria.
We end our show today, as we do every week, with a little sabiduría, or words of wisdom. Today's sabiduría comes from our own producer, Marlon Bishop, who recently went on a reporting trip to Honduras, the country with the highest murder rate in the world. And it's a very dangerous place to work as a journalist. 51 journalists and communication workers have been killed there since 2003, according to the Honduran Committee for Free Expression, a local NGO. Marlon tells us what it was like to work alongside local reporters who risk their lives every day to bring Hondurans the news.
The first time I heard gunshots in Honduras, I nearly dropped my recording gear. The shots sounded near. It must have been obvious that I was freaked out because my Honduran reporting partner started laughing. "You'll get used to it," he said. Honduras is known as the world's murder capital. I've been told you can buy a hit on somebody's life there for only $50. It'll cost a little more if they're famous. A few months ago, I was in Honduras reporting on things like gang violence and migration. Since coming back, a lot of people have asked me if I was scared to be there. The answer is, honestly, not really. And that's because I was working alongside veteran Honduran journalists who do this kind of work every day. If they weren't worried, I figured I didn't have to be either. One of my reporting partners was Inmer Chavez, a reporter for the community news station called Radio Progreso. We spent many long hours driving through Honduras together and talking about our different lives in the same profession. Inmer is 35. He's short in stature, with strong indigenous features and spiked black hair. Most days, he wears bright neon-colored polo shirts tucked into jeans. Inmer received his first death threat in March 2010.
Y las amenazas fueron vía mensajito.
He says the threat came via anonymous text message.
Estamos asesinando a los periodistas que hablan.
We're killing journalists who say stupid things like you, it read. The next message was even more direct. The next journalist we're going to kill is you.
Asesinar.
At Radio Progreso, Inmer reports on a whole range of terrifying people. Shady government officials, powerful landowners, drug lords. So the threats could have come from anywhere. He reported them to the authorities, but he wasn't expecting a response. Despite Inmer's cool exterior, he told me that he's constantly afraid.
Bueno, el miedo es constante. El miedo es constante.
He says every time somebody walks near him or drives close to his car, he thinks about the bullet he's been promised. I remember feeling that way too. I started noticing that I would hold my breath every time a motorcycle pulled next to our car at a red light. It wasn't quite fear. I knew logically that the man on the motorcycle was most likely a normal person on his way to some normal place. But in the back of my mind, some tiny morbid part of my brain would play out the other scenario. The man reaches down, takes out a gun, points it at my passenger window. Click. The light would turn green, the motorcycle would drive off, and I'd exhale. We might share that experience, but otherwise, there's a big difference between Inmir and me. After 3 weeks in Honduras, I would hop on a plane back home to New York, and Inmir would stay there in Honduras. My three-week adventure is just his everyday life. I asked Inmir why. With all the danger, with the family and kids at home, why not just leave journalism altogether and do something safer? I don't know, become an accountant. He says he can't quit, because as a journalist, he's doing his part to build a better country. And to some people, that may sound naive, but I believe in him. So many of Honduras's problems have to do with impunity, the fact that the powerful can get away with just about anything. Journalists like Inmir are fighting against that impunity by speaking their deeds to the world. Now, a lot of people all over the world say they get into journalism to make the world a better place. It's easy to pat yourself on the back for bringing light to an issue. That's all well and good. That's great. But I don't wake up in the morning every day and put my life on the line just by showing up to work. I didn't decide to make that sacrifice. My stakes are so much lower. And that's the difference between Inmir and me.
Latino USA producer Marlon Bishop. That's it for this week. Latino USA was produced by AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Camilo Vargas, and Antonia Cerejido. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our intern is Laura Calzada. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin, and I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week, and in the meantime, check us out on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr, and I'll see you on Instagram. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all. The Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. And the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the strengthening of international peace and security at carnegie.org.
Why don't we just do censorship in the we talk about? Can't we do that?
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the May Family Foundation, supporting Fountain House, committed to providing opportunities for people with mental illness to live, work, and learn through a community of mutual support. More information is available at fountainhouse.org. And Emily and Antoine Van Ochtmail, supporting New Futures, which works to help low-income D.C. area youth graduate from community college or certificate programs and become financially self-sufficient. Information is available at newfuturesdc.org. This is NPR.
Queridos y queridas, if you love what we do here at Latino USA, I hope you'll take a moment to go to latinousa.org and click on the donate button to support our work. As you know, we're a nonprofit, so contributions from you, no matter what the size, are what makes this podcast possible. Gracias for believing in what we do. Do help us, y hasta la próxima.